Juan, welcome to the February 23rd meeting of the Measure 91 Implementation Committee. We really appreciate your attending on such a beautiful day when there were a lot of other things to do that did not involve sitting inside a hearing room. So thank you and welcome. We're going to begin with an informational hearing, and then we're going to take a break from that and introduce a couple of committee bills. But with...
We're okay.
Ah, very good. All right, no. I am actually going to open a work session, and we are going to introduce a couple of committee bills. So,
Madam Chair, I move that LC 3338, dated February 23rd, 2015, and LC 3339, dated February 23rd, 2015, be introduced as a committee bill.
Representative Wilson moves that LC 3338... dated February 23, 2015, and LC 3339, dated February 23rd, 2015, be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bill. Any objections?
No.
Still none, so the measures are introduced as committee bills. Thank you. And we will now close the work session. All right, and now we will move to opening the informational hearing, which is going to be really interesting tonight. We've got a bevy of speakers on important environmental protection issues, and I think a lot of us recognize that marijuana production is going to provide some important economic activity that does not involve paving over, you know, some of our prime farmland, but it also raises some important environmental protection issues. And we've got some great speakers here tonight. So without further ado, let's get started on that agenda. We have, for our first panel, we're going to discuss some land use and exclusive farm use, EFU issues. And I'm going to welcome to the front Steve McCoy from 1,000 Friends of Oregon and Kelly Madding of the Jackson County Development Services Board, the director of that board, the commission. So thank you, both of you. Steve, if you'd like to go first, that'd be great if you could please introduce yourself for the record and then share your insights. We'd appreciate it.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, I am Steve McCoy, representing 1,000 Friends of Oregon. I do the rural policy for 1,000 Friends, so I will be focusing on the rural and farm issues. So my testimony is going to be brief. In fact, I wrote down four words, exciting, scary, conflicts, well, I guess five words, and unintended consequences. And those are the things that I'd like to talk about. Exciting. So it's exciting from the standpoint of a shot in the arm for potentially some agricultural interests that we might be able to have this high-value crop in places where perhaps we haven't had high-value crops before, or conversely, in places where we already do have high-value crops. So it is exciting from that standpoint. Scary. So I think that there is some fear in the farming community about what this will do to, for example, prices of farmland, or whether it will displace other products. As an organization, we have always been crop agnostic, in that if a particular farmer wants to farm whatever they want to farm, then that is fine with us. That's the decision that each farmer makes on his or her land. So we certainly aren't into regulating particular crops. Conflicts. So I think that's where we begin to see issues, maybe, is conflicts between different agricultural interests, as well as I think one issue that's probably been raised to the committee already, there's some language being drafted around it, is having to do with the farm income test. So a little background. I submitted a couple of exhibits on this, one that was prepared by BLCD and one that we prepared a few years ago as well. But it was recognized long ago, back in the 70s, whenever the land use program was first established, that the more dwellings that you have on farmland, the less likely it is that you are going to continue to have farming taking place. And the reason behind that is because then there is more speculation on land values. There is also more competition for farmers to acquire land so that they can farm. So one core piece of Oregon's land use program is to maintain agricultural lands in large blocks that can be farmed, and also to only allow dwellings in certain circumstances. There are actually six circumstances that dwellings can be allowed on farmland, one of which is accessory farm dwelling, I should say. And the accessory farm dwelling, whenever it is going to be established on high-value farmland, which are essentially the best soils in the state, whenever it's going to be established on high-value farmland, then there are two requirements. One is that the piece of land be at least generally 80 acres. It can differ between different counties, but generally it's going to be 80 acres. And the other requirement is that the farmer make $80,000 a year from their land. And this is to ensure that it's farmers that are seeking accessory farm dwellers rather than somebody else seeking an accessory farm dwelling on their land. Obviously, when you're talking about an extremely high dollar crop, if you can, on an 80-acre plot, only farm 3 acres, for example, and take the rest of it out of production and still be able to get a dwelling, that's a concern. So I do think that for accessory farm dwellings, the farm income test probably needs some tweaking. Unintended consequences. Well, I think that this is the sort of unintended consequence that is going to come up. And I don't think that we can nip all these in the bud at this point. But I do think that the committee, the legislature, is going to continue to have to be vigilant and watch how things play out on Oregon's landscapes with this. Thank you.
Great. Thank you. Ms. Madding, thank you so much for being here. If you could introduce yourself for the record, we'd love to hear your testimony.
Absolutely. Thank you, Co-Chair Langer and members of the committee. My name is Kelly Madding. I am the Development Services Director with Jackson County, and I'm here tonight representing the Association of Oregon County Planning Directors. I wanted to talk to you primarily about exclusive farm use land within counties. Cities and counties have some overlap in terms of zoning. For example, counties often have urban unincorporated communities within their counties and have some urban land use-esque kind of provisions of their code. But the main difference for the counties is that we have jurisdiction over resource land, both forest and exclusive farm use. And so I'd like to talk primarily about exclusive farm use land. And that brings me to a definition, and that definition is farm use. So it's key for us kind of land use policy wonks, that farm use and the definition is critical. The definition in this case, and I'll simplify it, is that you're growing a crop for a profit in money. So currently, growing medical marijuana is not considered from a land use perspective a farm use. So it doesn't afford the grower or the owner of that land kind of this bundle of sticks of rights that if you're a farm use, you can get. You don't automatically get it, but you can go through a process, a land use process, to get it. And I just want to be clear on that. So I'm talking about recreational marijuana under the auspices of it being a farm use, which I think hasn't been defined by the Oregon Department of Agriculture as of yet. But let's just say that it does get identified that way. So things that one could get with having a farm use is something like a farm stand. So you can imagine that someone is growing a crop, let's say they're growing tomatoes, and they want to sell those tomatoes on their land. And they can get a farm stand. They can go through a process and get one, the ability to do that. A farm stand for recreational marijuana may be seen as a little bit different than a farm stand for tomatoes by someone that is living next to it on a parcel that might be zoned rural residential. And in Jackson County, where we're highly parcelized, we do have situations, many situations, where rural residential is right next to EFU. In fact, I live on one of those parcels. And so the question is it appropriate for a farm stand selling marijuana to be located near or adjacent to a residential piece of property where that farm stand doesn't have the same security regulations that are imposed upon a medical marijuana facility, for example, which has a high level of security that is required? So that's just one instance. The other instance, and I'll echo Mr. McCoy, is primary farm dwellings. So that $80,000 gross revenue test for 2 years, when that was set oh so long ago, I think the intent was that, you know, farmland is finite and it's cherished for farming in the state of Oregon. And there was an assumption that if someone was making that kind of investment in a piece of land to farm, that an accessory use to that could be a house, a dwelling. It's my understanding that this test, this $80,000 gross revenue test, could be met fairly easily on a fairly small portion of that farmland, which might be 80 acres or it might be 15 acres. EFU doesn't have to be 80 acres. The minimum is 80 acres, but it could be far less than that. I think this poses a speculative opportunity for some to come in, have very little investment, grow marijuana for 2 years, build a house, and then sell it and move on, which would definitely change the landscape of the state, not just Jackson County. And so there's some concern about that as well, that gross income test. In terms of regulating where retail establishments go, in Measure 91, it talks about regulating place, time, and manner associated with a nuisance. And I will tell you that that is an ambiguous term. We sat down as planners at the last Association of Oregon County Planning Directors meeting and talked about what that means. And everyone had a different thought about what that meant. And I would recommend that the language that is used for medical marijuana dispensaries actually be used, which is regulating place, time, and manner, period. We do that extensively with our land development codes. It's very common to regulate place, time, and manner. It's not so common, in fact, it's not common at all for us to regulate place, time, and manner under the auspices of a nuisance. You have before you, the only thing I brought in hard copy was a copy of a land use compatibility statement. You all have that? It's actually a Department of Environmental Quality land use compatibility statement, and this is very common for state agencies to require applicants of land use endeavors to require a land use compatibility statement. It does not say that the use is permitted, that the county has permitted or the city has permitted the use. All it says is that it could be permitted. And I would encourage the requirement of this land use compatibility statement. It opens up a dialogue. It requires the opening of a dialogue between the local jurisdiction and the applicant prior to them getting a license or getting a license from OLCC, for example, and then not necessarily coming to the local jurisdiction for land use approval because they think they have approval. They got approval from a governmental agency, and they really don't see the difference oftentimes between the state, OLCC, and, for example, Jackson County. And it is an uncomfortable and often hostile and really tragic conversation to have with someone when we encounter them at the counter based on a code enforcement issue because they've opened up something that they can't in that particular zone and they didn't check with us. But they have a government permit, and that's a difficult one. I think this land use compatibility statement and the requirement of it would go a long way to negate that conversation that we might have. And finally, I think in terms of cleaning up some language around medical marijuana facilities, currently the law reads that a medical marijuana facility must be in an commercial, industrial, agricultural, or mixed-use zone. I think that language is slightly awkward, and I think it could use some cleanup as well. And that is, those were my points that I wanted to cover. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer.
That is exciting. We have a lot of questions, so lucky you two. We're going to start with Representative Helm and kind of work our way this way.
Thank you both for being here. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I really appreciate it. And since we have particularly Kelly's expertise as a planning director, one area of zoning that we haven't heard very much about is rural residential zones. And I think since we've got you here, if you could share some of your thoughts about the challenges of potentially regulating marijuana or marijuana businesses or growing operations in rural residential zones, that would be beneficial to the committee.
Representative Leininger, Representative Helm. For example, Jackson County, like I said, is a highly parcelized county. We have small farm parcels that are zoned EFU, and they're intermixed with rural residential parcels. Currently, our code reads that you could have a home occupation or a home business in a rural residential zone. Presumably, you could process marijuana. There's nothing in our code that prohibits that right now. I do see some potential conflicts with that in terms of these parcels are small. Like I said, 5 acres. And 5 acres may seem like a lot. And when I moved out to my parcel that's on 5 acres, I thought it was huge compared to the 4,000 square foot parcel I had before. But it's not very far from my neighbor's house. And I think that that conflict or allowing a home occupation or a home business would create some conflict in the sense that retail, for example, retail sales, we don't allow, and most counties don't allow it except by appointment. So someone could have like a hair salon and you would make an appointment and theoretically someone would come every hour. That would be almost impossible to actually regulate from a code enforcement standpoint in terms of retail sales for rural residential. I see some real challenges and actually conflicts with rural residential having the allowance for marijuana processing and or sales.
Thank you.
Representative Olson, did you have a question?
Nope.
Representative
Thank Buckley. You. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Kelly, thanks. Thanks for being here. As I understand Measure 91, and correct me if I'm wrong, but if a entity had to be a licensed retailer of recreational marijuana, wouldn't that take the farm stand issue off the table right there? Because you wouldn't be able to be licensed to sell marijuana on a farm stand because you hadn't met the requirements of the license. Is that your understanding? Do you think you need more in statutes for planners to be able to say very clearly, do we need to spell it out somehow?
Representative Leininger, Representative Buckley, I am not aware, and I would have to do more research, and I could certainly do more research and get you some more information on behalf of the Association of Oregon County Planning Directors on that issue. I'm not sure how Measure 91 and if recreational marijuana being a farm use, how those tie together statutorily. So I would have to do some more research, and I would be happy to do that and get back to you.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, and I'm sure we'll have legislative council be looking at this as well, too. I'm just speaking for myself, but I'm assuming my colleagues share the view that's not what anyone envisions from Measure 91. I seriously doubt anyone wants to see recreational marijuana sold on the side of the road in a farm stand. And on the other issue that you bring up in regard to the $80,000 sales or value of crops, if I'm reading you correctly, we should actually clarify that in statute that marijuana is not. Is your recommendation that we do not allow marijuana to be a crop that it would be the criteria for someone to build a house along the same lines we're doing now?
Representative Leininger, Representative Buckley, I would recommend, and on behalf of the Association of Oregon County Planning Directors, that you look at either increasing that amount or taking marijuana out of that equation.
Thank you so much, Kelly.
Representative Wilson, did you have a question?
I did. Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. To Kelly. Kelly, I was riding my motorcycle the other day through your jurisdiction. I went through Applegate, Oregon, and I saw on the reader board out front, said wanted 40 acres with good sun exposure. I was thinking, hey, wait, I think I know what we're talking about here. Question on that.
It's a winery.
Where would, in your world, as you described it here with the land use compatibility statement, how would that fit into a scenario like that where someone is openly soliciting for land and probably wants to grow marijuana on it? In your world, would it be a good idea then at what point in time would the land use land use compatibility statement be filed or whatever?
Certainly. Representative Leininger, Representative Wilson. I would suggest that in order to receive permitting or receive a license from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, that a land use compatibility statement accompany the application. So I would say at that point, I think, because it's typically provided by the state agency, the Department of Environmental Quality, the DMV, a variety of agencies require a land use compatibility statement along with the application or the information that they're getting to actually process a permit. So I would say that the appropriate time would be during that application period, that would be a requirement of the application from OLCC.
Okay. I have a follow-up. And I have received a lot of correspondence from landowners in Josephine County who have very difficult situations going on next door, people who are currently growing marijuana there. I'm hearing a lot about a number of dogs chained up, loud music at night, gunshots, things like this. What forum does someone in that situation have to appeal to when they're having neighbor problems like that? A number of people asking me about that, a lot of people frustrated about it, and, of course, the smell issue as well. So where do people go with a situation like that in county government? And I presume it's county government.
Right. Representative Leininger, Representative Wilson. That is a difficult one, I will admit. Jackson County, for example, doesn't have a noise ordinance. Growing marijuana is seen as an agricultural use, and frankly, an agricultural use is permitted right now in every zone in Jackson County, and we're not unique in that. Typically, when our policymakers are called on this issue, they refer people to the sheriff if it's a nuisance, loud music, those kinds of things.
Yeah.
But we get those calls as well, and we don't have anything that regulates smell. Mm-hmm. So the way Jackson County currently looks at this, and I don't think we're alone in this, although I think there are some counties that are looking to try to regulate marijuana grow sites, that we look at it as an agricultural crop, just like, well, growing recreational marijuana would be like growing anything else that you would make a profit and money at, and growing medical marijuana, we don't have any regulations on grows right now.
One final.
Okay.
Thank you. Then in that I think you mentioned, or yeah, I think you mentioned that growing marijuana is not considered a farm use, then the Right to Farm Act does not apply then to marijuana growing operations?
Not that I know of.
Representative Leininger, Representative Wilson. That I don't have an answer to.
Okay. Right.
I'll certainly take a note of that, and I can talk to our AOC counsel on that, and I can provide you some information back as well.
That would be helpful. Thank you.
Okay.
So I think we have questions from Co-Chair Burdick, Senator Farioli, Senator Beyer, and did a.
Oh, I'll throw one or two in after they finish.
Okay, great.
May I back up three questions to answer?
Sure.
Okay. Co-chairs, Representative Wilson, on the land use compatibility statement, I would go one step further, and instead of just requiring that the LUCs be presented at the time of the application, also that the LUCs say that the land use is compatible, because there have been issues in the past with state agencies. Whenever they see, oh, we have to have one. Yep, we have one, and it says it's not compatible. So I would go with that one step further.
Yeah, that seems fair. Co-Chair Burdick,
thank you. I know we have to develop policy to envision any number of circumstances, and it has to hold together. But I just wanted to find out in the real world. What is the status of the land where most of these medical grows, some of which will, I'm sure, move to the recreational area? In true fact, are most of them on rural residential? Are they on exception lands, or are they on EFU lands? Where, how do they break out in practice?
Representative Leininger, Senator Burdick, that I don't know, because they are not, we don't get any information on medical marijuana grow sites. The only thing I have is anecdotal from my building inspectors who go out to inspect for an electrical permit. And what they say is they're all over.
And a follow-up question on that. The ones that are in EFU lands, do they qualify for farm deferral if their only crop is medical marijuana?
Representative Leininger, Senator Burdick, no, they don't. They don't, because they aren't a farm use, they don't get taxed like an agricultural use. They don't. They can't avail themselves of an agricultural exemption, for example, not needing a building permit for an agricultural building. Mm-hmm. So, in short, no.
And if I could follow up, I was concerned about your point about, because some of these grows, I'm sure, will well exceed the $80,000 threshold for building a dwelling. And I think, you know, it is entirely possible the scenario that you suggested could actually occur, where someone could come in, get the dwelling, and then move on. Do you have any recommendations for, in a EFU land, and if this is a profit-making agricultural enterprise, it is a crop. So do you have any suggestions on that?
Co-chairs, I am sensitive to it being an agricultural enterprise, and we don't want to take anything away from that. However, either bumping up the dollar amount for marijuana would be an option. Another option would be making it so that marijuana is not included. As far as us, I think that there are probably a variety of different things that would alleviate the issue. So I'm not going to grasp a hold of one, unfortunately, and say, yeah, this is the one that we really want to see.
Well, thank you. I would like to continue the discussion on this, because especially in a place that's as highly parcelized as Jackson County, farmland is a pretty precious commodity.
Thank you, Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sure. Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm
You answered my first question. It has to do with whether or not a marijuana grow is considered an ag use. It is, if I understood you correctly. Isn't processing agricultural products an outright permitted use on agricultural land, Madam Chair?
Co-Chair Leininger, Senator Ferrioli. Processing an agricultural crop can be considered a commercial use in conjunction with a farm use, and some of those require a process. So yes, that would be, you would have to go through a land use process to do some processing of farm crops. And in most cases, that is the case.
Madam Chair, follow up on that aspect. Would just drying a crop be considered processing?
Drying.
Co-Chair Leininger.
There's many layers of that.
Senator Ferrioli, you know, I don't know the answer to that.
That's comforting, Madam Chair. Let's leave it at that.
Okay.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could follow
sure.
up. So the $80,000 rule, I just have to tell you that the idea that we would rejigger that rule is absolutely just the height of hypocrisy as far as I'm concerned. For years, people struggled with the $80,000 rule because agricultural produce just isn't that valuable normally. And some people went to blueberries and some to garlic and some to hothouse flowers in order to try to meet the requirement to have the ability to build on land. In some cases, it's been in their family 3-4 generations. In this case, a crop comes along that has the potential to easily meet that requirement. And now we're going to be asked to bump it up a little, you know, and I think that is clearly discriminatory. There's just no other face I can put on that. So that's not a question, just an observation. Madam Chair, if marijuana is an agricultural use, don't the right to farm laws apply?
Right to farm.
Co-Chair Leininger.
Absolutely.
Senator Ferrioli, I think that was similar to the question that Representative Wilson asked, and I'm not a land use lawyer. And I wasn't prepared to answer that question, and I'm not. But I can, like I said, do a little bit of research and provide some, try to provide some answer to that question for you.
The building's full of people doing the same research, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Last one is just fun for me, maybe not fun for anybody else. So whether or not a crop arrives at its current configuration through selective crossbreeding or genetic manipulation through gene splicing, can it not be considered a GMO crop, genetically modified?
She's not.
Co-Chair Leininger, Senator Ferrioli, and that was fun. That was a fun question.
Your answer is going to be just as much fun, Madam Chair.
I don't know the answer to that either, and that's ironic because I'm from Jackson County where we have the GMO ordinance. But I don't know the answer to that.
She's not a scientist.
Madam Chair, I think I've had enough fun for just this just this panel. The irony should escape nobody. If the Jackson County litigation goes one way and then the question arises if it's a genetically modified crop, it's banned. If it goes the other way and Jackson County joins the rest of the state of Oregon in recognizing that the authority that would be the one that we reference to determine what is the proper management regime to apply to genetically modified crops, that would be the Department of Agriculture. It just seems to me that that's deliciously ironic. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Ferrioli. I just want to say before we move down the line how much we appreciate you both coming in and speaking to issues that are all case of first impression issues. And I love that when you don't have an answer. You're just candidly saying it, and that is absolutely a fine answer. So thank you again for
Madam
your
Chair,
help.
It puts them in the same category as all the members of the
That's
panel.
Right. You seem to know way more than a lot of us do about this issue. Senator Przanski, did you have a question, or are we going to go
wait.
To Senator Beyer?
Oh, wait.
Okay. Thank you.
I think I've had an answer.
You had enough. All right. Then, Senator Cruz.
Well, a couple. Clearly, define an ag use, land for an ag use. So I know a little bit about ag, and I know a little bit about ag use. And because we raise 50 different crops, there's no place anywhere in statute that defines what an agricultural crop is there?
Yeah. Co-chairs, Senator Cruz, there is not, at least not that I'm aware of. So not to get too wonky, but ORS 215-203 is the statute that defines farm use. And what it says is farm use means the current employment of land for the primary purpose of obtaining a profit in money by raising, harvesting, and selling crops. So it does sound like farm use, yes. And then to Senator Farrelly's question about processing, farm use also includes, they use the word preparation rather than processing in here to say preparation of farm crops is a farm use. So processing is a different kettle of fish, and processing, the way that my understanding is the department interprets that, is that processing is things like, for example, slaughterhouses. And preparation would be, for example, drying marijuana would be more along the lines of preparation. At least that's my understanding of the current interpretation of Oregon's.
Well, processing would also be a winery, or we have a prune dehydrating plant or something like that, where and you aren't going to get EFU for that ground. You're just not. Nor should you. Preparation is an entirely different thing. But back to the ag crop, because we are dealing with something that's Schedule I on the federal level, would that require a special designation? And which I think is a reasonable question. I mean, if we can say it's an ag crop, but if we're running afoul of something federal, we may need to do something to define that.
Co-Chair Senator Cruz, I don't think there's anything within the land use laws, certainly,
right.
Or the definition of farm use where that would be. Other areas of law, I'm not an expert.
Okay.
I have absolutely no idea.
Okay. And the other thing, just so everybody's clear on the $80,000 thing, that's to build a house.
Okay.
You know, that's not to own ag land. I rent a lot of 15 and 10 acre parcels from neighbors, and I rent it from them so that they can show a profit, so they can still be EFU. But it's nowhere. They just have to show a profit, and that's it. So they're just to differentiate. So smaller sized EFU parcels would totally be eligible if you just want to grow something there. So.
Great. So, Senator Przanski, and then if Senator Beyer doesn't have a question, we might thank this panel and move on so that we can hear from the other fascinating folks. Senator Przanski.
So, kind of just some summations. The issue about the farm stands, clearly that can be addressed with notwithstanding or whatever we need to actually go in there. I mean, we've already got a framework for that. I did have a question for Kelly. There's part about $80,000 for as a demarcation over a two-year period, and then being able to put a house on that property. I mean, today there's nothing to stop someone from doing exactly that. If they chose to build a house and then relocate, they can then sell the whole thing. So we're not looking at something necessarily going to be new, or someone's going to run in and do this and then do it with the mind, oh, I'm going to sell this house to someone out in the country. Is that fair?
Co-Chair Leininger, Senator Przanski, you are right. There is nothing to stop someone from coming in and on EFU land, generating the $80,000 gross revenue test for 2 years, and then building a house and moving on. I do think that
you could put a,
that $80,000, when that was set, I think there was an assumption that that was a there would be a considerable investment to achieve that. Therefore, the person doing that would probably continue to farm and would, I guess, then be deserving of a dwelling on that farmland. But I agree with you. There's nothing right now that prohibits that from occurring.
Okay. And then I guess the only other two things, points is, I know what Representative Wilson saw when he was out on the motorcycle, this 40 acres, full sun. There are a lot of wineries down there, too, that could potentially be for wine as much as for marijuana. And I guess
combination.
That's right. You could have you could have two crops. And I think the last
infused
thing
wine.
Is coming back to what Purple Haze.
Domain name's already taken, Senator.
We don't want
to copyright
that.
No,
we ain't going there.
And so then the other thing is, Senator Cruz continues to talk about the issue we have with the feds on Schedule 1. I mean, we as a state scheduled marijuana as a Schedule 2 in 2009, and so in this state, it's a Schedule 2. It may be some conflict as to what the feds may think, but the reality is we as a state have the right to schedule substances as we find fit, and this legislature did that.
Right, Senator Beyer, you get the final word.
I do. I'm curious. Senator Cruz and I were talking greenhouses. Are greenhouses allowed in the FU?
Co-Chair, Senator Beyer, yes, they are. And also to get back to processing facilities, a processing facility of 10,000 square feet or smaller is also allowed on EFU as a conditional use if at least 25% of the crops that are going to be processed at that processing facility come from the site. So there's also a way to do processing facilities here.
I guess one last one. I'm just curious, from Jackson County, how are you going to deal with marijuana crop as opposed to the hemp issue? I understand you already have some crossbreeding issues there. Cross-pollination is what
you said. Yes.
And we have a marijuana and hemp issues panel right after you. So perfect to be aware of.
Segue right in there. Yeah.
So, Co-Chair Leininger, Senator Beyer, it's interesting that you bring that up. When OLCC came down and had their listening session at SOU, this issue came up about wanting to prohibit hemp growing near a recreational marijuana growing. And honestly, this is somewhat of a new ground for us a little bit. And no one had called Jackson County and asked, you know, about the relationship or the prohibition between hemp and marijuana. And so right now, we wouldn't do anything. If hemp is considered an agricultural crop, it can be grown in Jackson County. I guess it's permitted. And same with marijuana.
Yeah. It's probably not a land use issue. It's probably a Department of Ag issue. We have similar things with canola and other similar crops.
Yeah.
All voluntary, though.
Madam Chair.
Yes, sir.
Just check the beet seed wars that are going on in southern Oregon.
Well, I've heard about that from my parents. So now that we've solved all the issues related to land use and EFU, we'll thank this lovely panel. Thank you. You did a great job. And we will call up panel two on hemp and marijuana, which will consist of Ross Caro from OSU and Michael Johnson from the Talent Health Club, and also Andrea Herman. Is that what that says? I don't have my glasses. Henman from the Ridge International Cannabis Consulting Firm. So we're going to start, please, with Mr. Caro, and then we're going to go to Andrea, who's going to be calling in, and then conclude with Michael. So, Mr. Caro, if you could introduce yourself for the record and let us know what we need to know, we'd be grateful.
Okay. Co-chairs and committee members, my name is Russ Carroll. I'm a professor emeritus with the Crop and Soil Science Department at Oregon State University. I have over 30 years of experience in working with an array of crops. Marijuana nor hemp are not among them. So the information that you're going to hear in over just a few minutes is from literature reviews and from talking with colleagues in Canada. And Andrea Herman, who you will hear from in a bit, has far more experience and on-the-ground experience with hemp crops. And so she will be able to add real-life experience to the conversation. So I was asked to address three specific points, specifically the cross-compatibility of marijuana and hemp, the kind of distances that you might look at in order to try to avoid cross-pollination, and then what is done. We've already mentioned the canola situation, what's being done in other instances to try to isolate crops when you have cross-compatibility capability. I had prepared a handout. The first couple of paragraphs are going to give you far more botanical information than you're probably interested in, but it will describe what we know to be the case with both marijuana and hemp. They are one and the same species, and as one and the same species, they are cross-compatible. The crops are both wind and insect pollinated. From a wind standpoint, the specific studies that have been done, the pollen at the most distant point could travel 7.5 miles and can reach altitudes of, what did we have in here, up to 98 feet. And so you could, in theory, have a fairly significant spread of pollen. Insects, bees, in studies that have been done in Oregon, bees are known to travel up to 2.5 miles from their hive. And so, again, if you think about bees going opposite directions from their hives, then you'd be looking at a 5 mile isolation distance that a bee could move over. The 7 miles is the theoretical possibility. The thing that we can look towards are rules and regulations that have been put in place in Canada, in Europe, for isolation distances of hemp crops. And on the back of the sheet that I'd provided you are some draft regulations that were developed for possibly for the state of Oregon. They've not yet been adapted, but those come from both European and Canadian standards. And there they're looking, there are different grades of seed. The purest, highest grade is what's called foundation seed, then registered, then certified seed. And the isolation distances that are used in other countries for those different grades of seed range from 3 miles at the most distant for the foundation seed down to a mile for the certified seed. So I think at a minimum, you're looking at least a mile, if not 3 miles, isolation between a hemp and a marijuana crop. As we'd indicated before, we have other similar situations where there's cross compatibility among specialty seeds in the Willamette Valley. The way the specialty seed growers have addressed that issue is through a voluntary pinning system that's been in place for several decades. In the pinning system, the growers involved in the system originally were physically pinning a map to show the desired location of a production field. Over the last several years, the specialty seed growers have moved to an electronic pinning system, but it has the same components to it. There are rules and regulations that anybody who's involved in the pinning system must follow. And the biggest issue and where canola came into the mix is the system only works provided you have an adequate land base to separate the crops. And the minute you start to increase the number of producers who have a limited land base of their own, then potentially you have conflicts. But a pinning system could potentially be used to separate the crops. And again, you're looking at distances of at least a mile, probably closer to 3 miles in order to avoid issues.
Okay.
Thank you.
Fantastic. Thank you. So if we could now reach Ms. Herman on the phone. That would be great. And then after that, we'll go to Mr. Johnson.
One and hemp. That's a different strain.
And then we'll take questions. If you could speak for around 5 minutes, if everyone stays to about 5 minutes, then we should have a lot of time for questions, which are ample in this crowd. Hi, this is Ann Leininger. May I speak with Andrea Herman, please?
This is her.
Hi. Thank you so much, Ms. Herman, for joining us today to talk about issues related to hemp and marijuana growing and how our Measure 91 Implementation Committee can help ensure that those things happen as harmoniously as possible. We would love for you to take 5 minutes, if you would, and let us know after you introduce yourself for the record what things you think we should be aware of as we help implement this statute legalizing the adult use of marijuana here in Oregon.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, everybody on the committee, and for Adam for reaching out to me for input, and of course, Russ and all the work that he is doing. My name is Andrea Herman. I am physically located in Manitoba, Canada, where I've been working here with the hemp industry for the last 15 years and 20 years overall in the hemp sector. I am an authorized hemp sampler for the federal government here in Canada and work globally on legislation. In addition, I am an instructor at Oregon State University for eCampus course WSE 266 on industrial hemp. I am a professional agrologist working in large-scale agriculture, hemp agriculture, in addition to economy-of-scale agriculture. I was brought in to the topic pertaining to the cross-pollination issue potential between industrial hemp and marijuana. I have gone on the record stating that it is a risk for our colleagues in the marijuana sector to have industrial hemp growing in close proximity. What that proximity is the burning question. I do not have a defined answer to what the minimal safe distance between different types of the generic cannabis resulting in impurities in their offspring. All we can go on essentially is the OSCA's draft or the OSCA standards for seed certification. If we look at their certification, and this is been adopted, is being drafted and adopted into the United States from the Canadian regulations. The minimal distance between two types is 500 meters, so approximately 3 miles. Is 3 miles enough to prevent pollinization? More than likely, I would say professionally not. We know how far wind can travel. Depends on where the location is, the moisture in the air, the heat, perhaps on how long that male pollen stays viable. But as we know, when we're talking about the cultivation of industrial hemp for in purposes of either fiber only or for grain or seed production, when you're growing industrial hemp for a fiber-only type of application, typically you're taking the crop down when the males are starting to pollinate, but before the females are receptive in industrial hemp. So some people may say that that would be one option for cultivation practices or cutting for silage. It still would not prevent any male plants from opening. From working in the breeding plots, you are starting to really rope those plants or remove any off types really early on, and you can still have male plants forming quite early in the season within the first 1 to 1.5 months. You can start to see male plants starting to form in the field when we're talking about maintaining these. And these are when you're in the plots every other day maintaining those. Of course, our colleagues in the medical cannabis adult use marijuana sector, I being one of those people, knowing that you prevent the males from appearing at all. It could be a huge economic disaster and hardship for a marijuana grower that's indoor or outdoor production has been contaminated by male pollen. And no guarantees of how to really protect that, even with indoor, how good are the filters. We do not have regulations in the Canadian industry or in any other hemp industry that I know of that has faced this dilemma right on. Underneath a political framework, I can say that from personal experience, when I first came to Manitoba and met people that were in the marijuana growing industry, some of those granted at that time were operating underneath our medical access program. In the area that I came where hemp was introduced, they didn't really smile too much knowing that I was a hemp person, because essentially they had told me that all of the hemp coming to the area had basically pushed out any marijuana operation or pushed out any homegrown or indoor a homegrown type of operation because of the amount of pollen that was coming in. And granted, this was a larger amount of acres that was coming in into an area. So I can say that there is a risk. There is potentially some options with regions, but how do you decide that region? A question I have is if, you know, what happens if somebody comes and buys land on the intention of cultivating industrial hemp on it, and then that land sits fallow for a year or so, and they come back and they have a medical marijuana facility that has been permitted in the area. I'm not for sure how that's going to work, you know, sort of such as if you're going to have to make a public announcement that you're intending on building a marijuana facility, and if anybody has an issue with that in a particular region, how would that impact the farming community?
Well, those are all really important issues that you raise. I see that Senator Cruz has a question. Would you be open to, after you take Senator Cruz's question, sticking on the line for a bit, and then we'll have our last panelist speak for about 5 minutes, and we could perhaps address questions to any of the three of you at the end?
Yes, I am in agreement.
Great. Thanks. So, Senator Cruz, fire away.
As we are thinking about this, the isolation of hemp and marijuana, I think we also need to consider the isolation of marijuana and marijuana just to protect the purity of whatever strain a grower is having. So I think it's not just hemp and marijuana, it's also marijuana and marijuana. So it's something to consider.
Good point.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with you, especially for those growers that are actually breeding with the male pollen or using growing in that type of format. Most, as we know, most marijuana productions are from clones, but still some people are starting from seeds. So absolutely, that contamination can occur between all the genera of cannabis, no matter what the end purpose of the cultivation is for.
All right, thank you. So, Mr. Johnson, we'll turn to you now. If you could begin by introducing yourself for the record and then share with us what you think would be helpful for us to know as we wade through this issue.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, thank you for having me here today. My name is Michael Johnson. I'm the owner and operator of an outdoor cannabis farm, Gratitude Farms, located in Williams. I'm also the general manager of an OMMP dispensary in Talent Health Club. I came to speak to you today regarding the cross-pollination issue from industrial hemp to our marijuana farms. Personally, I've been farming outdoor medical marijuana for 8 years. I approach this subject from that perspective with that bias, and I want to be clear on that. Also, I just want to state that I'm a huge supporter of industrial hemp, and I really believe in its potential for this state. I apologize if any of this is repetitive, but Cannabis sativa is a plant that's dioecious, meaning it has both male and female plants. When you plant a cannabis seed, you don't know which one you're going to get, a male or a female. On my farm, like most medical marijuana farms, we work hard to keep every male out of the garden, eliminating all pollen. This is crucial because premium medical marijuana is inherently seedless. If any grower were to have his medical crop become pollinated and get full of seeds, its value both medicinally and economically would be greatly reduced. When growing industrial hemp, on the other hand, male and female plants grow together, packed tightly, with little differentiation between the two. Pollination and seed creation is an integral part of the cultivation method. Males reach full maturity, drop their pollen, and let the wind do the rest. It's easy to see that hemp and marijuana are not the best of neighbors. one grown for seed, one that must remain seedless. It's imperative that we're sensitive in how we introduce hemp farming into Oregon. From a medicinal perspective, we have cause for concern on two fronts. In the case of hemp pollen cross-pollinating a medical crop, you have the simple degradation of the medicine, where the harvested medicine is low in quality, low in potency, and has little commercial value. And then there's the problem of contaminated genetics. See, growers like myself have been breeding specific strains of medical marijuana for years, both to suit our unique microclimate and also to suit the unique needs of our patients. In the situation where our crop became pollinated by hemp, all that hard work would be out the window. The genetic purity would be lost, the strains would be lost, and we'd be back to the drawing board. When pressed on the concern of cross-pollination, hemp advocates often speak about how the maturation timeline for hemp and for medical marijuana are different. And they'll tell you that hemp pollen releases in the middle of the summer and that the medical marijuana outdoors doesn't start flowering until the middle end of August and finishing in October. This is really a vast oversimplification of what's really going on in marijuana farming in Oregon. In fact, marijuana is flowering 365 days a year in Southwest Oregon. With new agricultural techniques utilizing greenhouse environments, farmers are able to harvest crops in February, in April, in July, anytime they should so choose. So the argument that the maturation cycles don't line up and therefore hemp poses no risk is simply untrue. The other principal concern with introducing hemp into the ecosystem is the concept of invasive species. Hemp, once introduced, will establish itself in non-cultivated areas. This is something I know firsthand, as I was raised in the Midwest, where hemp cultivation was encouraged by the U.S. government for the World War II war effort. Even though it's been over a half a century since hemp was farmed, it's everywhere. In fallow fields, in irrigation ditches, anywhere it can hang on. Growing wild and free, the pollen rolls across the Great Plains. And today, seedless marijuana cultivation in this part of the country outdoors would be literally impossible. With the reality I've just described, it's easy to see how special of a situation we have here in Southwest Oregon, especially in Jackson, Josephine, and Douglas counties. We have a clean, virgin, pollen-free environment that is capable of producing some of the highest grade marijuana in the world. This is something very special, and this is something that now needs our protection. Ironically, the first hemp license in Oregon was awarded to a farmer who intends to plant 25 acres smack dab in the middle of the Applegate Valley, one of the most pristine outdoor marijuana cultivation areas in the country. Ironic as it may be, and believe me, the irony is not lost on me, this is an issue that needs our attention very quickly. For hemp cultivation is to begin this spring. And as it stands, we have a really scary commingling that's about to happen, with consequences unknown and with liabilities unassigned. I take this as an invitation for us to address this problem now before we let the genie out of the bottle and before it's too late. We have the opportunity to regulate these two agricultural production methods so that neither jeopardizes the other, so that both of these industries can flourish in their own right, and so that we can be a model for other states to follow. Commingling hemp and marijuana production is simply not an option. Too much loss and too little benefit. By creating exclusive agricultural zones designed to protect these two industries, we can ensure protection for all parties involved. Thank you.
Wow, that was great. Thank you, all three of you. Let's start with this side. Does anyone have questions on this side? Co-Chair Burdick.
Thank you. Pardon my ignorance in the botanical world, but we've been hearing a lot from marijuana growers who are concerned about hemp contaminating the marijuana crop. But does it work in reverse? Could marijuana cross-pollinate hemp so you'd end up with clothes that made you high or seeds that...
Don't soak those clothes.
So the issue would be the seed that's produced, and in order to have something qualified as a hemp crop, it has to be less than 0.3% THC. And so it wouldn't necessarily be an issue in the crop that's being pollinated, but if that seed were saved and planted in a subsequent year, you could have a hemp crop that would not meet the definition of that crop. So that is an issue as well.
And granted, just to further reiterate the point the gentleman who spoke after me, which was very good, thank you, I stand by everything you said, was that in growing of marijuana, the point is to prevent those male plants from ever forming. Because we've moved into a seedless bud industry. So that's a key goal. So the chance of marijuana, in this case pollinating the industrial hemp, is very, very small because of the horticultural practices and the care that the typical professional marijuana grower will use.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification. If I could just follow up really quickly. Is this issue unique to outdoor growers, or would indoor growers also be affected by this issue?
Ms. Herman had addressed that earlier, that we don't know if the filters, there are filtration systems that are on greenhouses and growing areas, and whether those filtration systems would be adequate to prevent the influx of pollen is unknown at this point.
That is interesting. So we have Representative Buckley, then Senator Cruz, and Senator Fraley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Michael, thank you for your testimony. Thanks for coming up to inform us on the issue. And it's hard for me to believe I'm even asked this question, because several members of this committee were very strong advocates of getting hemp into Oregon agriculture. I take it from what you're saying that at the very least what we should do is put a moratorium on hemp production until we can figure out which areas of the state that it would be grown safely and not conflict with the crop of another farmer.
Co-chairs and Representative Buckley, that's exactly right. That's what I advocate for. I feel like it's too soon, and I feel like we need more time to discuss this before we introduce this new crop.
Well, we've waited this long, so we might imagine, just to follow to in regard to the issues at Senator Fairley, I'm pleased you're concerned about Jackson County. I sent you the definition in the ordinance from Jackson County just to make sure that you have that definition. And I do believe that Michael and his colleagues at GROW are not impacted by Jackson County's GMO ban. Thank you.
All right, then. So we have, did anyone want to speak to that, or are we all set? Okay, so Senator Cruz and Senator Crayle.
Okay. I know you're growing a seedless crop. I grow seedless watermelons, too. But the seeds have to magically appear from somewhere. So so where is that grow?
Co-chairs and Senator Cruz, for me personally, it's all I can speak for. I actually keep a male or two every year, segregated, either in a greenhouse or an enclosure. The process of creating seed is very delicate. You have to be extremely careful. Using gloves, plastic baggies, a small paintbrush, you collect the male pollen at the right time. You go outside on a very still day with no wind, and you choose one small branch to pollinate, so we have seed for the next year.
Okay, if I could follow up, something similar. Somebody suggested to me once that one way to keep worms out of corn was to put baby oil on the tassels of the corn, which would work, except I wasn't about to go do that on 40 acres of corn. So the question is, you get to economies of scale, you may actually have to have a grow. So there's that isolation as well. Mm-hmm. So I mean, that's the point I'm getting at, because the seed's got to come from somewhere, and on a small scale, you can be very precise. On a bigger scale, you may have to actually do something or let nature take its course to a larger degree.
Mm-hmm. All right, so Senator Farioli, and then Ms. Herman, I really want to thank you for hanging on the phone. It may be hard for you to hear and respond, but after Senator Farioli and the response there, if you'd like to offer any parting thoughts, we'd love to hear from you, and then we'll let you go. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Has anybody discovered in their extensive experience or literature search any other plants that can be adapted or that produce THC? Besides cannabinoids.
Co-chair and Senator Farioli, not that I'm aware of.
Okay. Has there ever been...
Ms. Herman?
Oh, I was just saying, I agree, not that I've ever heard of. Only other forms of THC I've heard of are synthetic forms.
Okay. And for years there have been advocates, Madam Chair, of the hemp industry throughout the Pacific Northwest, and rumors that people were planting hemp, you know, sort of, you know, in a revolutionary act of defiance. And I just wondered if there's any evidence that that's occurred.
Co-chairs and Senator Farioli, not that I'm aware of, again.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And not that I'm aware of in the state of Oregon.
Great. And Ms. Herman, do you have any parting thoughts in response to any of the dialogue that you've heard here before we thank you for your time?
I think I just have a couple of comments. There's already some, you know, internal roadblocks within our hemp legislation, which Russ may have pointed on that, pertaining to such things as pedigreed seed production legislation and recognizing pedigreed seed within the states. And one of the gentlemen did speak about, you know, how finally when they're saving and, you know, when he's doing his very, you know, particular pollinization of his few male plants that he's isolated, we have to think about, as he pointed out, most varieties of industrial hemp are approximately 50-50. So 50% of those seeds that you're going to plant are going to be male plants. And that is a large amount of pollen coming out of the field. I am an authorized hemp sampler for the federal government here in Canada, which means I go into the field and collect the pollen. And I can tell you from first account, some of the fields are so inundated with male pollen that I have to wear like ski goggles and a face mask to protect myself from basically gagging from the sheer amount of pollen in the air, and that I have to like wipe my glasses off to remove the pollen. So just to give you an idea of about the sheer mass of pollen that would be in an acreage of industrial hemp versus a very particular isolation of a couple of male plants in a small cultivation economy of scale medical cannabis production.
Okay, well, thank you. And we'll thank you now. And you can sign off if you would. Gentlemen, if either of you have any final thoughts based on the questions that were posed here that we didn't get a chance to have you answer, please feel free to say a minute or two of stuff.
I guess just a hemp status. As you're aware, ODA is issuing licenses at this point. One of the issues that we are indeed faced with, as Andrea mentioned, is trying to legally bring seed into the state. And we've had some interesting conversations with the owners of proprietary varieties in other parts of the world who at this point in time are not interested in having their varieties brought into Oregon, as one person said, into the Wild West. And there are, for all of the issues that we've been talking about.
Great, thank you. You're all set. All right, panel, this was wonderful. Thank you so much for being with us. And
messy mails are, didn't we?
So after two great panels, we have two additional great panels. And the first is going to be speaking to issues of energy and energy conservation. You know, as we know, indoor grows require a fair amount of energy and raise some interesting issues. We have Brendan McCarthy of PGE here with us and Ruchi Sadhir of the Public Utility Commission. We're so pleased to have you both here. I apologize if I said that name incorrectly, either of you. And Brendan, how about if you start us off, please introduce yourself for the record.
Co-Chair Brendan McCarthy with Portland General Electric. I spoke with Ruchi earlier, and she would like to go first. And so if I can...
If it's all right with you.
Absolutely.
With you,
please do.
Thank you.
And both of you, if you could speak for about 5 minutes so that we have time for questions, that would be lovely.
Sure.
Thank you.
Good evening, Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Burdick, Co-Chair Leiniger, members of the committee. My name is Ruchi Sudhir. I'm the Senior Policy Advisor at the Oregon Public Utility Commission. I was invited to talk about the potential effects of indoor agriculture on energy demand and opportunities for energy efficiency. I'll briefly cover four main topics today. The first is the PUC's jurisdiction of industrial-owned utilities. The second is the Northwest Power and Conservation Council and some of the studies they've done. The third is consumer-owned utilities and Bonneville Power Administration. And finally, fourth, the Energy Trust of Oregon. So first, the PUC's mission is to ensure that safe and reliable utility services are provided to customers at just and reasonable rates through regulation and promoting the development of competitive markets. The PUC's oversight of utility services is largely limited to private investor-owned utilities like Portland General Electric and Pacific Power. About 25% of Oregon's energy consumers, however, are served by 37 consumer-owned utilities in generally more rural settings across the state. The PUC does not have oversight over the consumer-owned utilities, but they are regulated by their own boards. So for a more holistic view of energy in Oregon and the Pacific Northwest region, the Northwest Power and Conservation Council conducts rigorous energy studies and analysis. And the council has projected some energy demand growth because of indoor agriculture and has studied data from Washington State and its marijuana market to help inform those projections. The council currently estimates a regional load growth of 180 to 300 average megawatts used in indoor cannabis production by 2035, and that's calculated from estimates for cannabis demand in each state in the region, Oregon, Washington, Idaho, and Montana. So for some context on that number, one average megawatt is 8,760 megawatt hours of electric energy. And although these numbers don't generally relate, one megawatt, just for an idea, can power 1,000 homes. So given the demand for electricity is expected to increase, there are two main ways to meet that demand. The first is to, of course, build power plants to generate power, and the second is to invest in energy efficiency measures to just reduce the demand itself. So as I said earlier, there's two general categories of utilities. So the first type, consumer-owned utilities, they largely benefit from hydroelectric power from Bonneville Power Administration, which again is not regulated by the PUC. Bonneville administers and helps with energy efficiency measures in the consumer-owned utility territories. So while I don't speak for Bonneville, it is my understanding that they have received guidance from the U.S. Department of Energy that Bonneville cannot enter into any direct contractual relationships, including financial assistance programs with end user customers that cultivate or distribute marijuana. And so that's a federal policy that they're having to deal with. And switching gears to the area where the PUC actually does regulate in investor-owned utility territories, the Energy Trust of Oregon is an independent third-party nonprofit organization that encourages a competitive marketplace for cost-effective energy measures for the ratepayers that are in those investor-owned utilities territories. Energy Trust serves about 1.5 million commercial, residential, industrial customers of these investor-owned utilities in Oregon. And the PUC, on our behalf, we oversee and audit the Energy Trust on a regular basis. The Energy Trust provided services and incentives that have helped customers of Portland General Electric, Pacific Power, Northwest Natural Gas, and Cascade Natural Gas save about $1.7 billion since 2002, since its inception. Utility customers as a whole benefit from energy efficiency programs offered by the Energy Trust because it generally costs utilities and their customers less to just save energy waste rather than build energy generation and the related infrastructure. This approach generally keeps rates affordable in Oregon. So while the Energy Trust and the PUC have not specifically examined the use of energy efficiency measures for marijuana production in investor-owned utility territories. There are existing energy trust efficiency programs that producers, like any investor-owned utility customer, could benefit from. For example, the energy trust offers incentives for energy-efficient lighting, greenhouse covers, controllers, and then heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, or HVAC systems. But in order to be eligible for these types of energy efficiency, lighting, and heating incentives, an active business must be registered with the state of Oregon. The energy efficiency measures must be installed on a permanent structure, so not like a trailer, a more permanent structure. The business must be in an investor-owned utility service territory, and the project installation type must be pre- and post-verified. And there also might be some other additional eligibility requirements depending on the project. So what this is all to say is that it is possible that more widespread adoption of energy efficiency, cost-effective energy efficiency measures like these by growers and by other utility customers could help decrease the demand and stress of energy and transmission infrastructure. But the availability of the incentives may be limited by the location of the business or the type of utility that's servicing the site, and other eligibility requirements. And I'll pass it over to Brandon here.
Great. Thank you. Thanks so much. Welcome.
Thank you. Again, Brendan McCarthy with Portland General Electric, for the record. I feel a little bit like old Monty Python, and now for something completely different. because everybody I talk to, anytime I mention marijuana growing and why PG would have an interest, there's this immediate, huh? And then slowly the light sort of turns on. So PG is an investor-owned utility. As Richie mentioned, we serve about 70% of the state's GDP. When I first got into looking into marijuana issues, it was several years ago, because our energy theft division came to me and said, you know, we've got this issue with a lot of energy theft relating to grow operations, and we'd like your help. What I found was, polling my compatriot utilities, they didn't seem to have the problem. PGE was really sitting out there alone, and we found, in a large part, we have a lot of the marijuana card holders, and we have cloudy weather, so we have a lot of the indoor grows. This is from the Power Council. They currently estimate we're using about 37 average megawatts to serve marijuana grow operations in Oregon. That, interestingly, I suppose, to me at least, nests fairly neatly with our current integrated resource plan energy efficiency target. That's a lot of energy. Predicted to grow to about 78 for Oregon, so double it by 2035. For comparison's sake, in Colorado, Xcel Energy, which is an investor-owned utility there, saw 0.8% load growth over 2 years attributable directly to marijuana growing. That's a significant amount of power. Just to give you another picture from the Power Council, four plants and an indoor grow operation uses as much electricity as 29 refrigerators. Those kinds of figures begin to make energy executives, utility executives, think again about where that energy is going to come from. So that's a great little graphic I like to throw up for you. So I divide this into two sort of categories for us: commercial growing and residential growing.
It's a lot of power.
Commercial growing uses a lot of energy. You've seen the Oregonian articles, article recently, people who leased a 5,200 square foot establishment were using, had a $1,400 a month power bill. That's probably in the neighborhood of 13,000 kilowatt hours a month, 18 times the standard usage per square foot of other commercial uses, and an awful lot of energy per square foot. In Xcel, they're seeing, again, average sizes of 500 kW to 2 megawatts. That looks like a small data center to us. We have a few small data centers that are in the 2, 3, 4 megawatt range in our service territory. The one issue we ran into in the medical marijuana grower discussion was that we could not get information where the grow sites were. So if we have a problem or an outage or an issue where we need to upgrade service, we don't know necessarily why. Or if we've got an outage and we send people to go fix the outage, they don't know whether they're arriving at an illegal grow operation or a legal one. So we're there to deliver power. We're not there to talk to the police. We're not there to turn anybody in. But sometimes where you need to restore power, it's in the back of a lot. It's in a dark spot. It's not a place that a lot of our line guys want to go when they can smell marijuana outside. So we need information where these sites are. We also need them to tell us what their power needs are going to be. And if we have enough time to before they move into the establishment, we can upgrade their service. We can deal with the line extension that they need. We can install bigger transformers and give them the power quality that they want. But we need a little bit of time, and we need honest information. We need people to say, yes, we're actually going to grow marijuana, and it's going to look like this in terms of load. It doesn't help us to have someone say, well, we're going to start a pottery business, and we're going to have a lot of kilns running. We've heard that. You know, these are the things that you hear. And then we size their service wrong, and then they have power quality issues. So in a sense, we're here to do what we've always done, which is to provide safe, reliable power at a reasonable rate. On the residential level, it's similar. 85% of our transformer trips are pretty much related to illegal and legal grow operations. We don't know. Again, we'll send somebody out. We'll replace the transformer. It'll pop again. We'll send somebody out. We'll replace the transformer. It'll pop again. And finally, we'll go, there's an issue here. A recent example down in Oregon City. Two houses were fed by a 15 kVA transformer, which is a relatively small neighborhood transformer. It tripped several times. We finally went out and found that one of the homeowners had a 12,000 kilowatt hour a month usage. So we upgraded the transformer to a 50 kVA, and now the homeowner's service isn't adequate. So we're in a situation of being able to provide the power but not being able to turn them on because that house could go up in flames. We have a number of examples in our service territory. I could list them off. House fires that are related to marijuana grow operations. So we're in a dicey spot there. It's a safety issue for us. It's a safety issue for the homeowner. The other issue is neighborhood transformers serve more than one house. In this case, it was two. Sometimes it's three or four. You could have people's power going out because of the grow operation and just not having that information to size that system right. These are some of the things we've seen. There's actual pictures from our energy recovery folks. Bottom left is a power theft. Up in the center there, that's some home wiring. Probably didn't get a licensed electrician to do that work. Over on the right-hand side, it's a nice little spaghetti wire operation there. Actually, that picture there, too, is not from our service territory, but you can see the inventive wiring structure. So finally, I guess I've got three things. I'm concerned about the safety of my line crews and my workers. I need information to make sure that we can provide the power quality that people want. And finally, we need to work on energy efficiency, folks. This is going to be a lot of energy, and we've got a requirement to reduce our carbon. We're always looking to reduce our energy, and this is going to be another thing that we're going to be looking to try and reduce. So thank you very much.
That's great. Senator Beyer.
So, Brendan, what did you say the average grow was, power usage?
Senator Beyer, co-chairs, in Xcel's service territory, we heard that their average commercial size was 500 kW to 2 megawatts.
To 2 megawatts. Mm.
You have a follow-up?
And again, it's a good load once it's operating. I mean, that's great power. That's a great power load for a utility, just nice and steady.
Great load factor, yeah.
So Representative Buckley and then Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I understand, the city of Arcata, California, adjusted their rates after so many grow houses came into being in Arcata, and I believe that they used kind of the stick and the carrot and the stick thing. They did energy conservation, obviously, but they also boosted rates if you used over a certain level of electricity in a certain month, your rate skyrocketed. Do you have the ability to do that throughout the state, even with the customer-owned utilities? Can those rates be adjusted to kind of penalize the high use?
There are different rate structures that utilities use and that boards and PUCs require that incent behavior. So you're right. If there are time of use restrictions, if you're using energy at a certain peak time or if you're using energy over a certain threshold, that may bump into a different rate. And if you want to speak to PGE.
Co-chairs, Representative Buckley, something like an inclining block rate would be interesting, although you could raise other issues with that. But you could certainly design rates around. You could put a special, again, it depends on information. It might not work so well on a residential level, but depending on, you know, you could establish a special commercial rate. We have dozens of rates currently in our tariffs. So.
Just two quick comments, Scott. Yes, I think we do now have industry groups. We have a Growers Association. We have the Southern Oregon Growers Association. Have you been in conversation with any of these industry groups about these issues?
Co-chair is Representative Buckley. I have spoken to the ACMM a couple of years ago, the medical marijuana folks. I've talked with the health authority in the past. I've spoken with a couple of the lobbyists in the room here. But consistently, no. But it's on us to do more outreach, for sure, certainly.
It'd be great to have a plan. Just from your comments about communication, the land use folks brought forward the form that they're suggesting to be part of the application for licensure. I think it would make sense to have some sort of part of the application process be, have you communicated with your local utility and developed a plan for utility use? I think that would be a reasonable thing to do. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair.
Right, Senator Farioli, and then anyone else on this side? All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A question for Ms. Sadir. Did I get that?
Mm-hmm.
Would you expand on your testimony about the consumer-owned utilities in their relationship with Bonneville Power Administration and the potential, I guess, from their perspective, the misuse of their services?
So with co-chairs, Senator Farioli, with the caveat that I'm not here for Bonneville, just through my research, I have learned that the way Bonneville does their energy efficiency measures is they have a certain amount of their rate that they collect, and then they can use that as an incentive for energy efficiency measures within the consumer-owned utility. And I think it's that funding mechanism which is being prohibited. That doesn't, I think, stop the boards or the utilities themselves from doing energy efficiency measures. It just, I think, stops the funding aspect of it.
Madam Chair, the question, excuse me, was... Sure. I understood you to say that the Bonneville Power Administration is prohibited from providing power to anything that would be prohibited at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
So that was more of the point of the question. And does that, would that prohibition pass through to preference purchasers, and that would be the consumer-owned utilities?
That is not the way I understood it. I understood it to mean only the monetary incentive for energy efficiency measures. While you're right that the way I described how you meet that demand is generation or energy efficiency, to reduce demand, it appears as though the federal government is only focused on the energy efficiency measures because of the monetary incentive, that link.
Okay. Madam Chair, I think I'm going to circle back. I have more consumer-owned utilities than any other member, and I'm going to ask the managers if there are any issues that could feed back to the that would jeopardize their status as preference purchasers under their current agreements with Bonneville. I can see somebody suggesting that because of the federal law violations,
mm-hmm.
and the federal character of Bonneville Power Administration, that liability might in fact pass through to the preference purchasers since they have a special relationship mm-hmm. with this federal agency. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Well, we have one question from Representative Helm, and then we're going to transition to our final panel after copiously thanking you for your great information.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and thanks for your testimony. I'm wondering, is for residential purposes, we have an allowance in the existing statute for 4 plants per person. Can you give, is there a ballpark that you might say is a safe number of plants per your average residential household without any upgrading or safeguarding of the, you know, just say, somebody just wants to start growing plants, which is going to happen pretty soon, and they don't want to upgrade their electrical box. How many plants could they go for safely before you needed an upgrade?
Co-chairs, Representative Helm, it's a good question. We have 842,000 customers, and about 735,000 of them are residential customers. I can tell you that there are a vast, diverse number of ways we deliver energy to those 735,000 people. I've seen homes with 60-amp service still, and that's four fuses of 15-amp circuits each. And I've, you know, you've got homes with 340-amp service now. So to answer that is a hard one. I can't. Ultimately, our tariff says that if you're going to change your usage significantly, you should contact us. Do people? Most people don't. But I think it's sort of the same answer as if you were going to put in a hot tub, would you call us? I think you should. Now, do people put in a hot tub and not call us? Absolutely. So I'm not enough of an electrician expert to answer that on the stand and give you a statement as to the number of plants, because it varies dramatically. And when I was doing work on looking into this, you know, those grow bulbs come in various sizes, all the way up to 1,000 watts apiece. I would ask, how long do you want to run your hair dryer?
That's the rough equivalent.
Well, hair dryers are about 1,200 watt draw. So how long do you want to run your hair dryer before you might begin to worry that your electricity system might not be adequate? That's what I would worry about. Thank you.
That's very helpful.
All right. Thank you so much. Really appreciate your time today. And we have now our final panel of this series of four fascinating panels on pesticide issues related to marijuana grows. We have Steve Pettery from Oregon Wild and Joe DeFrancesco from OSU. Thank you, gentlemen, for being here. Excited to hear from you. Mr. Pettery, if you could kick us off, that would be great. Please start by introducing yourself for the record and then let us know what you think we need to know.
All right. Thank you very much. Thank you, Co-Chairs Burdick, Leininger, and members of the committee for having me here this evening. My name is Steve Pettery. I'm the Conservation Director for Oregon Wild. We're a nonprofit citizens advocacy group working to protect Oregon's wildlands, wildlife, and waters. My knowledge of marijuana grow comes from our experience with federal public lands, where illegal grows have been a very large issue in Southwest Oregon and other parts of the state and in other parts of the country. And I think as we move towards creating a regulatory environment here for a legal marijuana industry, looking at that experience from federal public lands could be demonstrative of some of the problems we can expect and some of the challenges we should be planning ahead to address. And, you know, on that front, folks have probably seen some of the headlines in the last few years out of Southern Oregon, Northern California, around the use of chemicals, pesticides, herbicides, rat poisons on federal public lands. This has been a major issue where folks have been applying these to try and increase their yields and produce more product. We're expecting that we're going to see that hopefully phase out, but at the same time, new grow operations on private lands around the state. Some folks are going to be probably converting over from other types of agriculture where they should have good knowledge of how to use these chemicals responsibly. Some folks may be new to agriculture and starting from scratch. What we want to see coming from that is a regulatory environment where we are providing state agencies with the resources they need to be proactive, specifically thinking about Department of Environmental Quality, Oregon Health Authority, the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, to come up with rules and regulations and to monitor the development of the industry to make sure that we're protecting drinking water supplies, we're protecting salmon-bearing streams, we're protecting wetlands, and we're protecting fish and wildlife resources. And that's really the primary concern we would have as you're looking at these issues around chemical use by the by this emerging industry. We really have state agencies who have very little experience in regulating this industry. We are probably going to see this industry emerge in places like Southwest Oregon, where we have existing issues around salmon and steelhead runs, endangered species, water quality, and water diversions. You know, some streams already flow too low in the summertime for wild salmon and steelhead. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife is in charge of monitoring those resources and making sure we're not issuing more water rights, for instance, than a stream can support. I'm not aware that ODFW has any plans for how they're going to address, you know, emerging requests for new water rights from some of these streams. Similarly, DEQ, ODA, Oregon Health Authority, not aware they have any plans to develop regulations to protect the resources they're charged with overseeing. And finally, the last thing I wanted to mention, one of the things we have experienced in the last few years is concern has grown around the timber industry's use of pesticides and herbicides in the state. Organic farmers, folks who are Oregon Wild members, Oregon Wild supporters, have been very concerned about chemical drift from the application of aerial herbicides. I think this is something we can expect to see as the marijuana industry grows in Oregon. We're going to probably see land conversions, some new land develop that's adjacent to forestry operations. And I think it's worth planning ahead for how we address things like aerial spray and chemical drift. There's likely to be conflicts down the road, and I think it's probably a good time to be re-examining the rules and regulations we have here in Oregon around aerial pesticide spraying and ensuring there's transparency and good public access to information about when sprays are going to take place, where they're going to take place, and what chemicals are being used. And that's all I have. Thank you very much.
That's great. Thank you so much. Mr. DeFrancesco, welcome.
Oh, yes. Good evening. Thank you for the invitation. I'm Joe DeFrancesco with Oregon State University, assistant professor, senior research. I did not prepare a statement. I was under the impression I would answer questions, so hope you're generating some questions, but I'll give you a little background. I do work with specialty seed and specialty crop growers in the valley, and most of our crops in Oregon are specialty crops. Anything under 300,000 acres nationally is considered a minor crop or a specialty crop. So I work with these growers on managing pests, integrated pest management, and one of the integrated tools is using pesticides. So I do work with growers on the safe use of pesticides. One of the areas of one of my programs that I have that I work in is collecting residue data for the Environmental Protection Agency. As everyone knows, before a pesticide is registered in the United States, it's vetted through the U.S. EPA. We have a program up at the North Willamette Research and Extension Center near Aurora, Oregon, where we test unregistered pesticides against a whole variety of different crops, send that data in with the laboratory analyses of those crops for the residue levels. The EPA reviews this, and they set what's called a tolerance or a maximum residue level that they consider safe for human consumption. So I have a little bit of expertise in that area. I don't have answers for the new marijuana situation that's coming in July. I will say that it's a dilemma in that, consider that it's not a federally recognized crop. Our hands are tied at OSU. We're not allowed to consult, as I am, with other specialty crop growers. We cannot answer any questions about the production. And as far as pesticides, nothing will be registered until it's classified as a crop by the U.S. government. I work with a program, a federally funded program called the IR4 program out of Rutgers, New Jersey, and we have been forbidden to do any projects on any residue projects that I would do for any other crop. We cannot do it on marijuana because it's not considered recognized as a crop. So I think it's going to be a real dilemma for the state of Oregon. The safe use of pesticides is one thing, but when nothing is registered and nothing will be, I fear that there could be illegal use of pesticides on these crops, and that's something that the state needs to deal with.
Senator Fraioli.
Well, Chair, thank you very much. So if it isn't recognized as a crop, would it be considered a weed? No pun intended. I mean, if you found a grow, would you use herbicides, pesticides? Would those be?
If marijuana were growing in your cornfield and you considered it a weed, you'd be able to spray an herbicide that was registered in corn.
Did you say a follow-up? So we have a question from Representative Buckley and then Co-Chair Burdick.
Thank you, ma'am. Chairman, I think more of a, again, a comment. I think this is another area where the folks in the industry would be well served to come forward with ideas for industry standards that we met, since you're not able to offer your advice, but perhaps we could look to the industry to come forward with recommendations on what industry standards for pesticide use might be.
You're asking what my...
Yes, like, you think that's a decent idea, or...
Oh, most definitely. As it stands now, we have a very regimented regime for vetting pesticide use and their safety, and I believe that... I don't know what the answer is. I think there should be a system in place. I can't give you an answer because I don't know the answer. But I would like to see it regulated just like any other crop because of the fear that it could be the Wild West and anything can go on if we don't have some authority to go in and see what they're doing. One suggestion might be to a person can test for residue levels in a crop to see if there's anything there. We test, not I personally, but the state of Oregon has market basket testing where they go out into the market and they'll test crops, commodity off the shelf to see if what's in that crop as far as pesticide residues. And they could do the same thing with, I believe they could do the same thing with the marijuana, which would be a step in the right direction to see if they're using illegal pesticides or if there's been drift onto that crop. And then, of course, that affects what gets into the human body.
Did you want to speak to that, too, Mr.
I did. Representative Buckley, one parallel that might be worth looking at for this developing industry is within the timber industry, there are certifications like the Forest Stewardship Council. There are sort of best practices. And while we're in this period of sort of developing the rules as we go along, I think that's a model that might be wise for the industry as it grows in Oregon to come up with best practices and some standards to which people can hold themselves to, perhaps get a certification or a label that then consumers can judge, you know, the quality of someone's environmental practices through that certification.
That's interesting. Did you have a follow-up? Okay, so I think I have Senator Burdick and then Senator Cruz, Senator Farrelly, and then Senator Prezlansky. Senators, you're on.
Just quickly, I thank you, Madam Chair. We've talked about having a research license in the medical marijuana system where people could legally have the marijuana for research purposes. Would that sort of thing enable you to take a more active role in advising people and studying some of the impacts of these things?
I understand the question. I don't have the answer. It's not up to me. It would be up to the dean of the College of Agricultural Sciences and probably the president of OSU.
And as long as I have you there, and you did raise the issue of testing for pesticides, there actually is the capability to test for pesticides. Some of the labs do it.
Oh, correct. Yes.
And do you have any thoughts on how we can make that sort of testing more consistent? You know, what regulatory system would work in this area?
The way it works now for some other crops is more so for if crops are being exported, the grower or the shipper will take a sample and send it to either a private laboratory. We have several in Oregon in the Portland area who do pesticide testing, and actually the Oregon Department of Agriculture has a pesticide testing laboratory. They routinely take samples and send them to the lab to see what, even though they know what their growers are using, they want to make sure that it has not exceeded the maximum residue levels for a foreign market. So yes, that could be, it would have to be voluntary, I imagine. I don't know how the state would work, but that could be done before a grower is selling a crop. I don't know how it works, how they harvest or distribute, but they can test, or the state could ask to have the crop tested to see what the residue, if there are any pesticide residues in that crop.
Thank you.
So I think I had Senator Cruz, Senator Farrelly, Senator Prezlansky, and then I was going to ask a question.
Okay. Mine's not so much a question. For a lot of insecticides and fungicides, they're open label. The restriction is time from application to harvest. So for a lot of those things, it wouldn't be an issue.
Okay. Senator
Farrelly. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. So if marijuana is not recognized as a crop, are all current uses of insecticides and pesticides off-label?
Correct. They are, yes.
And that would be a violation of our agricultural practices.
That would be a violation of the law.
Federal law.
And if you don't follow, you have to have a label in hand, and if you don't follow the directions on a label, that would be considered a violation. And it's the Oregon Department of Agriculture that regulates it in Oregon based on federal law.
Those pesky federal laws, man.
One correction.
You are full of good insights this evening.
That's a correct statement on restricted labels, not open label.
Okay.
So you're talking about, restricted use pesticides.
There's products you have to be licensed to be able to purchase and sell. There's other products that anybody can purchase and use. That's a difference between restricted label and open label.
That's correct. There are restricted use pesticides where you need a license to purchase it and use it. However, any label, the grower has to follow the letter of the law on the label, whether it's a restricted use pesticide or not.
That's helpful point, though. Yes, sir.
Well, that's the law, but you don't have to follow it.
Madam Chair, the point, I guess, was that these are not shrubs. These are edibles and comestibles for human use. So I would think that would present a different set of label requirements and different considerations. So the open label stuff, I'm not sure the open label stuff is approved for human consumption.
There are insecticides and herbicides I spray on my berries, on my peaches, on all sorts of stuff, and the restriction is you have to wait a certain number of days after application because then it's gone. Okay. It's a contact spray.
Yeah, Senator Cruz is referring to the PHI, or the pre-harvest interval, and every label will say you need to wait so many days, either 7 days, 3 days, 1 day, between the time of the last application and the time of harvest. But there are also other guidelines and directions on the label that a grower must follow. Also, if they say you need to, only use 8 to 12 ounces per application and no more than two applications per season, you're bound to follow those guidelines. And if you spray three times at 14 ounces, you're considered in violation of the law, of the label, and it would be ODA would fine you as a label violation.
No, that's absolutely true. But that's what I mean about the fact that there are a lot of products you can use that are gone after a period of time, and so.
Oh yes. Okay. As far as if you were testing, certainly yes. Some have shorter. Yeah. Half-lives than other products.
I think Mr. Pedery, you wanted to add a comment, and then we'll move to Senator Przanski, please.
Yes, co-chairs and the two senators. I think what you're identifying is one of the issues we've wrestled with grows on federal public lands for a long time, that the labels require a certain use of these chemicals in a time period between harvest, and the folks who are often using them don't have a lot of experience with using them, haven't read the labels, or don't understand the labels. I think what we're looking at now as we move towards legalization, Oregon is hopefully addressing at least some of that problem, hopefully all of that problem. But there's going to need to be a period where ODA, other state agencies, are assisting folks who are developing these operations in understanding the proper use of these chemicals, the proper quantities, how to use them, how to keep them out of streams. In cases where it's someone who's converting from another form of agriculture, it's probably not a big problem. In cases where it's someone starting from scratch, it probably is. So I just wanted to raise that flag again of the need for agencies to be developing these resources and the regulatory environments quickly.
Very good point. Senator Provence.
So going back to the issue with OSU as to doing research, it's my understanding, I think the concern is at this point, because of the, let's say, restrictions the federal government has, that they're not, the university itself is not ready to put in jeopardy federal funding. That could, in fact, be impacted by taking up a practice or getting into an area that has not been sanctioned?
I actually don't know the details of it. What you suggest is probably correct. I think you can get, as a researcher at Oregon State, you can get a permit.
Yeah, get a waiver.
A waiver to work on the crop. But as far as those of us who provide education and outreach to conventional growers, like the timber industry, we won't be able to do that for the marijuana growers.
Okay. Did you have a follow-up?
And so then I guess the other part is Senator Burdick asked, I guess, some issues as to what you might be able to suggest regarding what type of testing needs to be done. We are anticipating we're going to have some type of regulations that anything that's going to be within this closed system is going to have to be tested for whatever residue molds as it is now in the medical field for the retail side. So if there's some stuff that you think as to the type of testing or level of testing or substances to be tested for, that would be beneficial for us to know.
Yeah, I could provide further information. Just briefly, right now, the Department of Ag and also these private laboratories, they will do what's called a general panel. They'll actually, you send one sample in and they could test for 400 different pesticides with one sample.
Right.
Some pesticides can't be done in that process and they have to be done individually, but that would be a start.
Well, that's really interesting. I wanted to just highlight that I was fascinated by your idea that the Forest Stewardship Council's sector created best practices to be adhered to by folks who are going to get certification for that standard or just be operating in the sector. Is a pretty interesting model, particularly given that we'll be operating without, the opportunity for NREC guidance because of federal funding restrictions. I also think that, as you noted, Mr. Pedery, we're going to be creating rules around a whole new sector, and it would be interesting as to application of pesticides to, try some of the concepts that have been intriguing to the conservation community for a while, like, advance notice, kinds of buffers, and longitudinal tracking of the amount and the type of pesticides used on different pieces of land so that we can track what the effects are and, what the cumulative effects are on the crops and on water that's nearby. So it's an interesting opportunity. With that, I think we should declare victory on four wonderful panels and thank everyone. I'm going to close the informational hearing. Thank you both for your patience and your insights.
Thank you.
And I am going to invite Co-Chair Burdick to provide us with a super compelling brief summary of what you have in store for you on Wednesday. Co-Chair Burdick.
Banks and law enforcement.
Money and guns.
Yes.
There you go.
Be the hero or be
square.
Well,
that's why you're going to DPS. That's
so, thanks, everybody, for coming. We look forward to seeing you on Wednesday.
Thanks, Matthew.
We had a good time with Ed Bayama.
Oh, yeah.
We had a good time with Ed Bayama.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Matthew.